before Malcolm comes up, next week's topic is going to be water scarcity in southern Alberta. Who's managing the precious resource? And the speaker will be Bill Berzins. So I'll ask Malcolm to come up and answer your questions.
Malcolm, you mentioned about there was a higher percentage of young adult male blacks being associated with the penal system than with the armed forces. Would the armed forces be a potential way for them to learn a trade after release from the penal system?
Yeah, about the armed forces, I'm not sure the numbers there, but the estimate by the Justice Bureau was that young men were more likely to go into prison than they were to go into the army or into college. But yeah, I mean, there's a possibility there. You don't want hardened psychopaths or something in the army any more than you want them anywhere else. But at the same time, if the army were to provide, say, educational upgrading and so on, it'd probably be an excellent and very constructive thing to do, especially after the Iraq War is over. Which no doubt it soon will be. John McCain will win the Iraq War. I've heard him say it.
Hi, my name is Knut Peterson. I'd like to have you comment a little bit more on the growing privatization of prisons, if that in fact is happening.
It is growing. And it is quite profitable, but I think the privatization, I mean, they're about 6% of prisons, the last time I was able to get something on that in the United States, are private prisons and run at a profit. And someone was mentioning at the table, I think it was Dr. Miller, maybe, can't remember who it was. No, it wasn't. Someone was mentioning at the table anyway that the prison being empty, and one of the prisons being empty in Montana, they're actually creating a profitable prison by inviting prisoners from other states, which and the space is certainly needed. So it's not only the much larger privatization is probably in the contracts for food and for clothing and all kinds of things. I mean, if you could sell plastic bags to every prisoner in the United States, it's a pretty good market, or for every prisoner, I should say, because they're usually bought by the government. Most prisoners in the United States are state prisoners. There are state prisons, there are federal prisons, and then there are county or local jails of different kinds.
Malcolm, thank you so much for a very informative as well as a humorous presentation. I can't help thinking that with the matter of liquor control during the period of prohibition being so recent, that we are allowing the same thing to happen with drugs, only on a much larger scale. Do you not think that the fact that we're overlooking the possibility of legalizing drugs is a great crack in the foundation of what our society stands for?
That's the real problem. I mean, I of course grew up in that generation that was familiar with all that stuff. But I don't think there is any illegal drug that is good for you. Although sometimes the marijuana advocates talk about how much more virtuous it is to smoke marijuana than to smoke. But then I was reading a medical report that said actually smoking one joint was equal to about 5 or 6 cigarettes in succession, so it's not that good either. But it's a problem that, we are creating great social problems over something in many cases that will probably take care of itself through the maturing of the population. Most of the people I knew in 1969 who smoked marijuana don't do it. I know one guy in Saskatoon who lives in a very small apartment and hasn't got a job who does it, but almost everyone else went on to do things. So I think sometimes we don't allow the agencies in our society, like families and churches and all those things, schools, that really can do things for people and that do inculcate some maturity, sometimes in spite of themselves, we don't allow those things to work. You know, we immediately criminalize something we don't like. And so I think it's the possibility that it's legal bothers me almost as much as the possibility of making it illegal and, you know, and incarcerating people, but not quite as much.
Terry Shillington, thank you very much for your presentation and helping us to laugh at ourselves. This may not be your area of expertise, but I'm wondering about the federal crime bill before the parliament that is one of the clutch of issues that's a confidence issue, I gather. Can you help us figure out what's in that bill and where it's going?
Yeah, I have to confess, Terry, I've read it a couple of times, and it's very hard to read these bills because, of course, they refer to other bills in the bill, and then you have to go get the other legislation and look at it. So I had about three things lined up, and I was trying to figure out what it actually meant. So far, from what I can tell, it's not particularly drastic, although it is in the direction of longer and harsher sentences and that sort of thing. But from what I've seen, the major provisions are more mandatory minima. There already were about 40 mandatory minimum sentences in the in Canadian law, criminal law, before this. And some more have been added. Quite a few more have been added, actually, although I didn't enumerate them. The lowering of the age of consent from 16 to 14, I'm not sure what practical problems that might cause. It's interesting in a very highly sexualized world that we're doing that. Whether we're creating something else, I don't know. Because I knew people were married when they were 16 when I was a kid. So it does seem to me a little previous. But at the same time, there's a new awareness of pedophilia and other problems that may necessitate this. I don't know. The other things were sort of the equivalent of the three strikes and you're out law that California introduced. But we've always had that to quite an extent with the dangerous offender provisions. And so they've been beefed up a bit, but I don't see that as a real three strikes law necessarily. California, of course, is reexamining that constantly and peeling back on many things because of the problems it's created. So the bill, it's making sentences longer, a longer minimum sentences quite often, much harder. The only place it affects drugs that I could see, and this is very rapid reading, knowing I was coming here, actually, was that the provisions were stiffened and drugs were added to provisions for driving while intoxicated so that it doesn't merely apply to alcohol, it also applies to other drugs. And all the provisions for mandatory testing of drivers and so on had some drugs added into them in some cases, and the minima were made more certain for that as well. I tend to respect the judiciary overall, the prosecutors and the judges and the enforcement officers as well, so that I'm not terribly in favor of reducing discretion simply because people's stories, as we were talking at our table, are so many stories that people have that judges and prosecutors and police have to deal with, and the one size fits all is always a problem. Cesare Beccaria tried it in the 18th century. It was his idea that you would have one sentence for this crime and another sentence for this crime, and that would be it. Everyone would know of this, and that would work as a deterrent. Well, it was very quickly discovered when people tried to employ that total mandatory sentencing that simply didn't work. It either destroyed the lives of people who were slightly in error, or else, in some cases, wasn't sufficient for people who were repeat offenders.
My name is Trevor Page, and I gather there are a significant number of child lifers in U.S. jails. Children,
yes,
sentenced in their early teens to life imprisonment.
Of the 22,
and I'm wondering if you could provide us with some information on that.
Sure.
Thank you.
There are 2,200 juveniles serving life sentences in the world. And all but 12 of those are in the United States. So that is a result of the other provision that people love to talk about, is sending children to adult supervision or to adult trials. And as a result, you have a substantial number of people who are in jail for life. They will live from the age of 12 or 13 in some cases to the end of their lives, because they're also in jail without parole in some cases, without any possibility of parole. So it's you're not the person you were when you were 12. I was much nicer when I was 12, actually. So I wouldn't have been jailed then, but certainly we change enough, I think, that perhaps we shouldn't imprison children for life.
Thank you, and my name is Nancy Brown. And my question is, why has this become this tough on crime? Why has it become so attractive in the last 30 some years?
I'm not sure exactly, because if you look at Canada, say the only real measure to me of violence is usually homicide. I mean, if homicide is up, then that indicates that serious violence is up. Canada's homicide rate peaked in 1975. Right now, it's among the lowest in the world. The crime rates vary. I mean, you're more likely to get burglarized in London than you are in New York. Certain crimes are much more frequent elsewhere than they are in the United States, for example, in the West. But is it a response to crime? No, I think it's a response to fear, a fear of crime. And I think it's a response. I don't blame the media, because they report what people want to know about. But I think, too, remember, we're on cable television now. And I know some people are getting a bit dotty, and most of my friends are, in fact. But, you know, they'll watch something about the schools in Detroit, and somehow it means the schools in Lethbridge. You know what I mean? There's a sense of all of this world closing in on one sometimes, because we have such excellent communications now. We see these things day after day. And we even see things in Toronto that we wouldn't normally have seen a few years ago. So I think there's a lot of that fear. But I think there are genuine problems that have emerged, such as gang problems in towns and cities that weren't there before. The problems of violence generally are lower than they were over the last 25, 30 years. That other curve I showed you has persisted. And now in the United States is a remarkable lowering in violence. And, of course, everyone who was the get tough person said, well, that's why, because we got tough. But it didn't quite work that way, because the violence suddenly dropped, even independently of any kind of get tough provisions, because they had to get tough for a long time. There's still a lot of violence. And I think it works to some extent. Don't get me wrong. If you imprison, if you imprison a couple of million people, you're going to cut down on the problem, no doubt about it, but you're creating another one that's probably bigger. But yeah, I think it's partly a response to fear, you know, that we hear and think about things. I notice as I get older, I get a lot more cautious in many ways, and I do think about, you know, if I see a knot of surly-looking young men and I'm walking along the street at midnight, because I live downtown, when I was younger, I would never have thought of that in that way, but, you know, sometimes I just feel a little nervous. They don't do anything to me. I walk past them, and they might make fun of me or something, but I've been used to that all my life, too. Yes, go. Sorry.
Bev Mendel-Atherstone, thank you very much for your talk. I'm very interested in the fact that you've brought up what happened in the 60s in your discussion, because during the 60s, I was a psychology student at the University of California at Davis and had the opportunity to work with Dr. Robert Fosen, who was a social psychologist and advisor to the federal prison system, and I worked at Vacaville State
Wonderful.
Medical yeah. Facility as an internship. One of the things that Trevor just brought up was child lifers. There were child lifers at that facility. The Vacaville had one-third sick prisoners, one-third prisoners in transition, and one-third lifers. The lifers, many of them were involved in an art program and sold such wonderful art that they were able to finance a little league team in the tiny little town of Vacaville. As a psychology student, I got to be part of the psychiatric team that was doing all kinds of research. And, of course, many of the things that you were saying were true at that time. There was a huge number of black Americans and clearly visible minorities. Poverty was a huge indication, high school dropouts, but also mental illness was a huge factor.
Yeah, I didn't mention that, but that is that's vast in every prison system, but particularly in that one.
Mental illness, learning disability, and then chromosomal abnormalities, and you know, that might be something to look up to. People, these were all males, but they often had multiple, so XYY and XXYY chromosomes. So my question has to do with the commodification of human life. And at that time in 1964, of course, you were talking about the political aspects of this. At that time, we had just lost Robert Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, and Martin Luther King. At that time, Ronald Reagan had just become governor of California. So all the good things that were being done in the prison systems, they were trying to open up the prison systems, give more education programs to the prisoners and so on. Those were closed down, and that was exactly related to political. Yep. So I'm glad you brought up fear. It seems to me, as now an American and a Canadian living in Canada, that we don't need a war on crime, we need a war on fear, and that fear is our biggest enemy. And I wonder why the Canadian system, federally and provincially, seems to feel that they have to follow the U.S. right down every little path, including the war on our own people and commodification of people, as we're seeing in the prison systems. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't think the Canadian people do actually particularly want to follow the United States. And the reason I'm worried about that, too, it's my fear as well. So that's why I talked about the path that is possible. If you do follow the United States, that's the path that ultimately you could go on. Highly unlikely that we will to that extent. But I think sometimes in Western Canada there's a sense that we're sort of a shadow people, you know. It's the real thing is in the States somehow. They always do better in the States. And but I think, too, it's this business of much better communication that tends to bring the world of worry to us. And the fact that we are an aging population, and that's one of the reasons homicide and violence have dropped so drastically in the States and here. I'll show you.
That was my desk graph, and I can't find it. Anyway,
the point is that the lump of people, the lump of the boomer generation, has gone through the population, and there is no equivalent mass of young people who are most likely to be violent. If anyone's going to do violence, it's going to be young men between the ages of about 15 and 30, and particularly the late teens and up to about 30. So that cohort of the population just isn't there anymore. And actually, there are some, and this will be controversial for sure, but there are quite a few penologists and demographers and so on who talk about the lowering violence as a result of abortion, of the legalization of abortion in 1973 in the United States, slightly earlier in Canada, that there are fewer unwanted children, fewer children in general, fewer people charged with abortion, of course. You know, that's an odd one that I found that I thought was sort of interesting. But I think we are an aging population ourselves, and I think that's part of our fear. And the United States is a very, very powerful culture. It's a huge popular cultural engine that generates everything the world over. It doesn't see very well outside itself, but and naturally, powerful countries usually don't see very well outside themselves. But it I think, influences us to that extent. I think you're right. There is always a sense of what's going on in the United States. As Martin Short said, Americans watch TV, but Canadians watch American TV. And so we have a kind of remove from it on the one hand. On the other hand, it's always there as an example for us. And I think in this case, you're quite right. I think we really need to be careful, because the commodification of people is what we are talking about. We're talking about people as if criminals were, there was a phrase in the 19th century, the dangerous classes. And criminals were not us, right? Those aren't human beings. And that's always the way it is. I can remember driving out, I forget whether it was Granham or where it was, a guy had a petition about the Young Offenders Act. And he was in, I was getting gas from him or something, and he said, well, would you like to sign this petition on the Young Offenders Act? And I said, well, what's in the Young Offenders Act? Well, he didn't know for sure, but he knew it was very soft. I said, okay, as soon as your son's arrested, I'm going to sign this petition against the Young Offenders Act. How's that? Because I think that's what makes the difference. And that sometimes is necessary, that someone like us or belonging to us has real problems, and suddenly we start to see that people who are implicated in these systems are other human beings and should be treated as other human beings, even if we must deprive them of liberty for our own security or for their own education.
Hi, my name is Henning Mundel, and as you've indicated, you don't necessarily shy away from potentially controversial views. My question may not be, the answer may not be controversial, but I want to ask it anyway. In the context of during your actual presentation for showing the graphs, you kept mentioning citizens, 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 whether we're talking about violence, about incarceration, and so on. What I wonder, are there statistics to what extent it is non-citizens?
Yes, there are. It's a very good point. And that's another one of the great fears. It's very interesting. It's all these foreigners coming in, you know, they're with their foreign ways that are causing crime. The statistics show there are a substantial number of foreigners in U.S. prisons. I think it's something in the order of 5 or 6%. I can't remember the statistic right now. But, in fact, the rates of offense are higher among Americans born in America but from the same countries as the immigrants. In other words, the immigrant rates generally are lower, even if they're not American citizens. Once a person gets settled into the good old USA or the good old Canada, for that matter, they learn things, right? I mean, they learn that they've got to carry a gun and so on, and they do. But no, it's a good question. It's one that's brought up all the time. And in the current election, Senator McCain, who was for a sort of amnesty for a lot of immigrants, illegal immigrants in the United States, is constantly confronted with this question. You know, these are the people involved in crime. No, they're not generally involved in crime as much as native-born Americans of the same ethnicity are.
Thank you for your talk, Bill Mayberry. I was wondering, in a globalized world, we're talking about the United States and Canada and crime. Is there any hunger for defining that crime as what happened in Chile under Pinochet, what is happening, you know, in Central America, what happened, you know, all around the world, Tiananmen Square, the war in Iraq, and so on. Is there any hunger or any conversation about that?
There used to be more of a conversation, Bill, than there is now. And I think partly it's because of Guantanamo Bay and because of the fact, another amazing fact, that Americans are actually publicly discussing the permissibility of torture. Suddenly, when you're working against the Geneva Convention, quite clearly, when you're outside of international law, suddenly you're not so keen to look at violations elsewhere. I think that's one of the problems that in this state of war that the United States finds itself in. So there's always been that interest that there should be internationally defined offenses. And the Geneva Convention was one of the ways, more about war conventions than anything else. And there are, of course, there's a World Court at The Hague. There are various other organizations, the United Nations and so on, that try to make such definitions and pursue such causes. But as soon as you have one of the big powers violating some of the fundamentals of these things, removing habeas corpus from its own citizens as well as others, and torturing people and making it public knowledge and even using evidence from torture at trial, it's a real problem. You know, torture was universally condemned in the 1700s and most of all by the United States as they became. And, of course, this is a shocking thing that we are actually having a public discussion now about how far we should go, whether trying to drown somebody is actually torture or it's just a good time or a sort of sport or a way of questioning. So I think that's the problem. I think that right now it would be pot calling kettle black, and I think that that's why that stuff has slowed down to some extent from the United States at least.
Are
Are you a veteran of the French Revolution by chance?
I am. My name is Eric Williams. My apologies for not turning up to my Tuesday lecture. But I do have a fractured patella.
I heard this, yes. It was in the news.
We talk about people doing things out of their own self-interest, and we have presumed to some extent that criminals are acting in their own self-interest as well, though you've thrown some doubt as to how much proportionally we have condemned them to the magnitude of their crimes and what their crimes really are. One could say, extrapolate also, I think, from your talk, that politicians actually are acting out of their own self-interest by showing themselves tougher in law and order issues. I'd like to turn the thing to the other group in the criminal justice department, and that is the lawyers, who I think are also acting very much in their own self-interest, and are very much responsible for the delay in the speediness with which justice is passed. And I do hold very much that justice delayed is justice denied, and I wondered whether you'd like to comment on that, along that lines.
Yeah, I think you're quite right. I mean, you can get into that sort of tautological world, Eric, where everyone is acting in his own self-interest, you know, and nobody's ever altruistic, right? You're always doing something so you'll feel better, even if it's an altruistic act for someone else. But I agree. I mean, I think the that frustration is sometimes reflected in things like the mandatory minima that are put on sentences and things like that, that frustration with the law. And it is true that in Canada we have an extraordinary number of the people who are incarcerated. We have a prison population of about 35,000 right now in Canada. Extraordinary proportion of those are in remand. They're charged, but they're not convicted, and so there's a problem there definitely, and it's true in the United States as well. A lesser proportion, about 20%, I think 15 to 20% are in remand. Here, it's closer to a third sometimes of our prison population are people awaiting trial. So, yes, I think they do act in their own self-interest. I think they are. The interesting thing about criminal lawyers, though, and those are the ones we're talking about, really, in this particular case, is that criminal law isn't generally regarded as a lucrative kind of practice. So that I think it's probably less likely in criminal law in some ways, because you really aren't, a lot of it's public defender stuff. Of the students I've had who've gone on to law, the ones who become public prosecutors and the ones who become corporate lawyers do pretty well. I mean, the public prosecutors obviously aren't terribly well paid, but they're steadily paid. But the ones who went to criminal law, put out their own shingle, I mean, it's a middling at best. It's a middling living. So I think there are tremendous egos involved and all that sort of thing. I think there are various kinds of gratifications other than delay in finance. But I think the only way to decrease these delays would be, part of it's legislative. Part of it is because they're delayed because these are charges that are questionable in some cases or ambiguous. But the other one probably is to provide more in the way, when you try to schedule a court appearance, quite often it is delayed simply by the lack of available courtrooms, judges, prosecutors, and all the rest of that. So it's a bit of half a dozen of one and six of the other. But I agree with you. I don't think we can exonerate any of us in this system, because it serves us all in some way, probably least of all the people incarcerated in it, but most of all the rest of us. You can make a pretty good living as a psychologist for the prisons. I mean, it's not great, but it's reasonable. You can make a good living as a guard. You can make a good living as all kinds of things. So, yeah, there's a good degree of self-interest, and that's why it becomes such a thorny problem, I think, to change things for the better. Is not simply because we're changing delay out of our general public interest, but we're affecting the interest of someone else every time we do it. If we build more prisons, of course, we have construction contracts. If we build more prisons, we have jobs. We have all kinds of things. So there's a vast self-interested public that's always involved in these things.
We have time for one more short question.
That's because I give extraordinarily long answers. You ask a professor for a question, and you get a paragraph, always, at least.
No, I was just thinking when it comes down to it, we need to look at it from the broadest possible standpoint, and that is that ever since the time of Adam and Eve, there has been crime. And somebody has said, of way back in history, said there is a God-shaped void in every man that can only be filled by God alone. And when it's filled with God, there's no crime. Because when God lives in our lives, there is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, and temperance. When that emptiness is there, then we'll go to alcohol, we'll go to this and go to that. And I think, I really believe, crime is caused, basically, if you may answer if that's right, it's a spiritual problem. And the reason we have more crime in America today is because the churches have become lukewarm and are no longer salt and light the way they should be. That's the way I see it. Am I right or not?
Yes and no. I think if everyone exhibited the fruits of the Spirit, it would be a fine world. But what I've noticed in quite often the religionaries who are talking about the question of crime, Christians often become sudden Old Testament patriarchs in many cases, and they want to give over to the blood avenger, you know, everybody who's slain another and that sort of thing, or have cities of refuge and generally holus bolus vengeance. So, quite so. I mean, there is no doubt that if the Christian gospel were the rule and were believed in, prison would be very, very small. That having been said, there are some things that are sin to us, but not crime. There are other things that are crime, but not necessarily sin. That's the area where sometimes we make the decisions, you know, the marijuana or the drinking. Sometimes, I mean, it depends, of course, on one's particular denomination, whatever the case is, but sometimes we make a decision to call that crime when it's not necessarily considered sin. And so I think generally what's universally regarded as sin is usually crime, usually if it involves killing or hurting. If you're getting the fruits of the Spirit together, you're using the Beatitudes, no problem with that at all. Good idea.
I'd just like to mention, if you folks know history, during the Welsh Revival, that's maybe 200 years ago, that revival went into America and went in different countries. And one of the things that came out was the policemen just had nothing to do. You know? And I understand there's supposed to have been a revival like that in Africa and in a village or so. Same thing. No more crime.
Well, no one had any money either, because I remember reading Benjamin Franklin went to George Whitefield, who led the Welsh revival, and he said, his first impulse, and this is Franklin, who's a cheap and nasty person in many ways, he said, my first impulse was to reach into my pocket. And so was my second and my third. And then he had no money by the end of the revival, right? So I think that was part of it. You know, the rich didn't have any money left. They'd given it all to Whitefield. But quite right. I mean, those revivals, I think, do concentrate the mind onto higher things and less onto lower things, as it were.
Thanks, Malcolm. Thanks, Malcolm. And next week we'll be on water management in southern Alberta. Thanks.